So Daniel chapter 11 is the prophecy we're going to go through this morning, at least part of it. It's a long chapter. Now, it's the last of the prophecies of Daniel that we'll look at in this very short series going through the prophecies of Daniel. It's the most detailed prophecy in the Bible, and it's quite long, and there's a natural break. And so today we'll go through the first 20 verses. And there's a break there because we're introduced then from verse 21 to an individual who we've encountered before. Remember, we've already looked at the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream. We've already looked at the four beasts that Daniel saw in his vision. We've seen the little horn that he referred to in Daniel chapter 7. And we saw how the Apostle Paul makes mention of that same individual who will appear at the end of the times, an individual who he refers to as the man of sin, that Daniel calls a little horn. We also saw in Daniel chapter 8 another little horn, not the same horn as the one we saw in Daniel chapter 7, but in Daniel chapter 8 we also saw another little horn, and he's the individual that he refers to here at the second half of this prophecy in chapter 11. This little horn we know of in history as a man called Antiochus Epiphanes, very specific individual who arrived at a particular point in time to persecute the Jewish nation. And we'll be looking at that maybe next time, not necessarily next week, but maybe in the next few weeks we'll finish off the chapter. But if you look back first of all to chapter 10, which we're not going to go into, but just to note the fact that Daniel here receives a vision and he sees what he describes as a man, one in the appearance of a man. Now, the word he uses, the Hebrew word he uses for man is Ish. It's not Adam. And it gives an indication that this is an individual in human form, but not necessarily a human being, not necessarily a man in the physical sense, but somebody who would arrive in the appearance of a man. So Daniel sees this vision. He's beside the river Tigris, and he sees a vision of a supernatural being he describes as being in the form of a man. But it's a vision. It's a vision. And in that vision, this individual, this what appears to be a supernatural human being. Some individuals regard this as a Christophany, that is an appearance of the Son of God prior to his coming in the flesh, but nevertheless appearing in the form of a man. It may well be. We don't know. It's not said that here, and there's no inference of deity here. However, it is a supernatural being that Daniel sees in his vision. If you look at verse 18 of Daniel chapter 10, verse 18, then there came again and touched me one like the appearance of a man, and he strengthened me and said, O man, greatly beloved, fear not. Peace be unto you. Be strong. Yes, be strong. And when he had spoken unto me, I was strengthened and said, let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. And if you look down to verse 21, this supernatural being that Daniel sees in the vision says this. He says, but I will show you that which is noted in the scripture of truth. And there is none that holds with me in these things but Michael, your prince. So he refers there to the scripture of truth. There is a heavenly word. Now we have in our hands the Bible. It's a written word. But there appears to be a heavenly word. God has written history in advance. God has written, if you like, his story. Because history, as somebody once said, is his story. It's God's story written. It's written in heaven, referred to as a scripture of truth. And you might remember how in the book of Revelation, which borrows a lot from the prophecies of Daniel, a great many images are borrowed from the prophecies of Daniel, when John unfolds the revelation in the last book in the New Testament, You noted there how he talks in chapter 20 of Revelation of the fact that when Christ returns and the dead are raised, he says the books are opened. Now, these are heavenly books. Now, these are books that God wrote with a physical hand or a literal hand with a literal pen, or typed on a sort of a literal, a supernatural keyboard with supernatural hands. But these are words of God written. This is something which he has in advance laid out. And we experience in time these things that God has already written, if you like. He knows the future from beginning to end, and it unfolds for us in time. But because it's his story, a story he wrote, and there are books in heaven which record all these things, and this book, of course, is God's word, which comes to us from what is written in heaven, from what is known in heaven, what is decided in heaven. These things are unfolded for us in time. So God also has a book, and that book is one that maybe we'll hear more about in the future. But for us, we have a book that derives from that book. The words of this book, of course, are taken from the book that God has written in advance. His story unfolds for us in history, unfolds for us in time, but it's nevertheless his story. These books, these events are recorded and revealed to Daniel. So the individual who's speaking to Daniel, the supernatural individual, whether it's a Christophany or not, we don't know, but this individual says to Daniel that, you know, the books are opened and I'm going to reveal to you what these books reveal. So these things are revealed to Daniel. So we go to chapter 11 of Daniel. We're going to go through verses 1 to 20. Now, there's a lot of detail in this prophecy. It is the most detailed prophecy in the Bible, chapter 11 of Daniel. So we'll take it slowly, in a sense, and go through it almost verse by verse, not reading the verses necessarily, but referring to the verses, because what's important, of course, is the unfolding of these events. What's prophesied is written here. What actually unfolded, we know from history. So here in chapter 11, Daniel is now an old man. Remember, he was a youth when he came to Babylon, when the Babylonian captivity took place. He was a group of young people who were taken from Judah and taken to Babylon captive. He was a young man, a youth, and now he's an old man here. And he's at a point in time now where Babylon has fallen. It's already gone. The empire has collapsed. It's no more. That was prophesied by Isaiah and others. And that's now happened. Babylon has fallen. Darius has gone. The leader of the Medes and the Persians is gone. And Cyrus is now king of the Persians. And this is the second year of his reign. That's all in chapter 11, verse 1. But in chapter 11, sorry, this is all in the first few verses of chapter 11. Verse 1, this individual that was speaking to Daniel in chapter 10, is still speaking here. So as chapter 11 opens, this individual is still speaking. Also, he says, I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood confirm and strengthen him. And now will show you the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. So this individual that appeared to Daniel, chapter 10, he's still speaking, and he's telling Daniel what's going to happen in history as it unfolds in the years following. So this is a picture that Daniel's giving to us of history unfolding. And we have in these verses in chapter 11 of Daniel, we have 375 years of history unfolded for us beforehand. Before these events take place, we're told about them in very great detail, very great detail, before these things have happened. This is a true picture of the future revealed to Daniel. So three kings will arise, and the fourth will be stronger than them all. This is, in history, a man called Xerxes, who took an immense army and attacked Greece. It was one of the largest ancient armies ever assembled. You can read that in the history books. He assembled a massive army, Xerxes, and attacked the nation of Greece. One of the largest armies ever assembled in the ancient world. He torched Athens. That's how far he entered into Greece. He torched Athens, burned it to the ground, and overrun most of Greece. But he couldn't. He wasn't able to destroy the Greek fleet. And so Greece survived as a nation, as a power. He wasn't able to destroy the Greek fleet. And the Greeks later counterattacked. And soon, very soon, Greece became the dominant power in world affairs. The man who led the Greek Empire into greatness, of course, was another individual that we know from history who's referred to here as Alexander the Great. Look at verse 3 of chapter 11. And the mighty king shall stand up, that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken. And this actually happened. This was Alexander the Great, one of the greatest military commanders in all of history. You read about him, he's well renowned as being a great military leader, a great man of conquest. His conquests were far and wide. He took huge portions of the earth. And in fact, he reached a point in his life, as we've mentioned before, where still as a young man, he felt there's nothing else to conquer. There's nowhere else to go. There's nothing. I've done it all. I've conquered the world. That's what he thought. So great was his empire. But it didn't last. While he was still young, he died. Actually, in Babylon, after a drunken bout, he sort of drunk himself to death. He just thought there was life, nothing else left in life. You know, nothing else to do. I've achieved it all. So he went on a drinking spree and just went, obviously, too far, just collapsed and died. Still a young man. He had a child, but his child was only a baby still when he died. And so his kingdom was fought over by initially 12 of his generals, and then that narrowed down to 4 of the strongest of them. And that's what it says here in verses 3-4. Eventually, the empire was divided into 4 parts, broken up, as it says here, divided up. And from verse 5 onwards, of course, concerns the 2 divisions that ruled the areas to the north of Palestine, referred to in this prophecy as the king of the north, and to the south of Palestine, referred to in this prophecy as the king of the south. So the rest of this prophecy concerns those 2 divisions, if you like, that rose to prominence to the north of Palestine, and to the south of Palestine, the king of the north and the king of the south. The king of the south was one of Alexander's generals, very close to Alexander. In fact, he was the individual, Ptolemy Soter, who took Alexander's body. That's how close he was to him. He demanded that he take the body, and he had it buried, I think, in Alexandria. I think it was originally buried somewhere else, or planned to be buried somewhere else, but he took it and buried it in the city that Alexander had founded, Alexandria. And he buried it there. So a very influential individual, very close to Alexander, one of his chief generals. Well, he ruled the area to the north of Palestine. Oh, sorry, my apologies. He ruled the area to the south of Palestine, Egypt. He ruled that area. Ptolemy Soter, his name was. And his dynasty lasted for a long time. In fact, it lasted till the reign of Cleopatra, you know, the famous Cleopatra that Shakespeare writes about. And in fact, throughout that entire dynasty, all these Greek rulers, descendants of Ptolemy, Soter, who ruled Egypt, Cleopatra, the last of the line, was the only one who learned to speak Egyptian. So he was the only one who spoke Egyptian. None of the others did. They were all Greek-speaking, as she was as well, but she learned to speak Egyptian and prided herself as being the queen of Egypt. But that's just an interesting side, if you like, But Ptolemy Soter took a prince under his wing, somebody who he thought was a great military strategist, a man called Seleucus. And this Seleucus was very, very able in his campaigns. And he eventually claimed the north territory as his own. He led a series of conflicts, and he took Babylon, retook Babylon, founded a separate Seleucid kingdom, his own kingdom, to the north of Palestine, rivaling Ptolemy's in the south. So originally working together, one of his generals, one of his commanders, he got too strong, was too able, and was able to found his own empire in the north. So you have the Seleucids in the north, and you have the Ptolemies in the south. And that's how this prophecy develops. That's how these kings develop as the prophecy unfolds. So this Seleucus is a brilliant military commander. We'll see a couple of others brilliant military commanders as we go through here. We've already met one, Alexander the Great, of course, famous in history as being a great military strategist. And this individual, Seleucus, was another. So he founded his own separate kingdom. So we have the Ptolemies in the south, we have the Seleucids in the north. That's all from verse 5. We can see how the prophecy describes those things. Well, before long, the Seleucus exceeded in power. His kingdom grew until it expanded to a sort of a much larger area than the empire of Ptolemy in the south. His empire grew and became the stronger of the two. So Seleucus' empire became the dominant one in the area. This is Seleucus the First, or Nicator, I think he's referred to. So it grew in power, it grew and became more powerful than the empire of Ptolemy. So that in fact, the whole of the eastern part of Alexander's empire, which was vast, Seleucus the First now controlled. Huge expanse, huge area, very powerful kingdom that he established for himself, rivaling the kingdom of Ptolemy in the south. In fact, this Seleucus the First, Seleucus Nicator, founded the city of Antioch, which of course becomes important for the Christian church to read in the New Testament. Antioch becomes a center of Christian mission from the Apostle Paul's time. Paul and Barnabas and then Paul and Silas and so on sent out from Antioch. So it became a very influential city. But here it was founded at this time by Seleucus the First. Verse 6. Verse 6 of chapter 11. It says that in the end of years they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. So these two empires who were always rivaling each other, there was a lot of tension, there were various skirmishes that took place over all these years, eventually decided, well, let's form a union. Let's put an end to all this fighting. Let's form an alliance. And they did this through a marriage. The daughter of Ptolemy II, by now, in the south, was married to Antiochus II in the north. He was the son of Seleucus I. So Antiochus II takes Berenice as his wife. He was already married, by the way, Antiochus II, but he took Berenice anyway as his new wife. But it didn't have the desired effect, because Berenice's father, Antiochus, died and took back his former wife. Berenice's father died, which sort of broke the alliance, and Antiochus, who'd taken Berenice as his wife, as his second wife, rejected her, put her away, and went back to his former wife, Laodice. And that was very unfortunate. It wasn't a very clever trick on his part, because Laodice eventually poisoned him and put his son on the throne. It's all about families not getting on, you know, sort of know, we think of families now, you know, very broken families and disunited families. Well, it wasn't any different back then. They did very strange, evil things to each other. So Laodice poisoned her husband, Antiochus, murdered Berenice and all of her children and all of her supporters. A vicious woman, Berenice. Laodice. A vicious woman. Murdered all of Berenice's supporters and set her own son on the throne of the northern kingdom, Seleucus II, or Seleucus Callinicus, I think he's referred to of in history. Verse 7 we're in now. Verse 7 of chapter 11. We're going through the history. I know it's not, I don't think, important for us to remember all these historical details. What's important we'll refer to later on. But it's important to know that these things were prophesied in detail before they took place. That's important to know. But the actual detail itself is, you know, is not so important. But not a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north and shall deal against them and shall prevail. So a branch of her roots, a branch of a brother of Berenice, ascended the throne of Egypt. That's the dynasty of the Ptolemies. He ascended the throne and invaded the north. He took an army and ravaged the northern empire. Took revenge on all those individuals who had murdered his sister and her supporters and her children. Took revenge on them. Verses 7 to 8. And he spoiled the north. Spoiled it. You know how in the ancient world, where they had these false gods and images, they saw them as protectors of the land. They had these stone images, these stone gods and wooden idols in various places. And they looked to them as being the ones who give the nation strength. Our power derives from these gods that we worship and we've set up in various places. So this individual carried all of those gods back down to Egypt. So the nation was then in the north seemed to be powerless. Its power was taken away as well. Not only was the nation ravaged, but he took all its gods and took them back to Egypt. So God revealed all of these things to Daniel in, it's almost mind-boggling detail. So specific. You'd read a history book, you could read these things. And, have Daniel 11 open, read the history of it, and you're amazed at how verse by verse these things unfold before your eyes on the page of history. It's quite incredible. In fact, it's so incredible that historians are convinced that Daniel was written after the events unfolded. Well, they have to believe that because they just can't take it that these things were spelled out in such detail before they happened. The detail is so clear that the historians are convinced that this book must have been written after the events. But God did reveal these things to Daniel before these events occurred. We know that. And that's exactly what happened. Verse 9 of 11. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. That's exactly what happened. Seleucus II marched against Ptolemy in the south, ravaged the country, landed a series of raids in the south, and then returned home to his home in the north. Verse 10. He went back home. Verse 10. But his sons shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overthrow and pass through, and then he return and be stirred up even to his fortress. So there were two sons. Seleucus had two sons. One perished in battle. The other became Antiochus the Great in history. He's the one who was stirred up. He's the one who became the greater of the two. So one perished in battle. The other became an individual that we know in history as Antiochus the Great. Now, his army came to the very border of the southern kingdom of Egypt, attacked the south with a multitude, one of the largest forces ever assembled in the ancient world. It included, amongst other things, there were cavalry, there were infantry, thousands upon thousands, and among all of that, there were 73 elephants also, a huge multitude of an army. And he came and attacked the south with this multitude. But he was defeated by the smaller army in the south. Look at verse 11. And the king of the south shall be moved with choler, and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north, with this great multitude, and he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hands. So the king of the north had this multitude, this huge army, including 73 elephants, but the smaller army in the south defeated it. Why? Well, because it was prophesied. That's why. It doesn't seem to be any other reason why that would have happened. It was prophesied to happen. And then verse 12. And when he had taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. So here the king of the south became filled with pride after this battle, after he destroyed this multitude of an army, routed them. He became filled with pride, inflicted greater defeats on the north, but it wasn't long before the king of the north had the advantage again. And that was through an individual who we know of in history as Antiochus the Great. Verses 15 to 16. And so the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the armies of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. This individual, Antiochus the Great, just did what he wanted. It looks like nothing could stop him. And he retook the Holy Land, amongst other things. But still, he couldn't conquer the south fully. The southern kingdom carried on. Now, as with all of these things, you have this tension, these wars, these rivalries, these endless conflicts, and eventually people think, oh, we have to do something about this. We just can't beat these people. No matter how hard we try, and it seems like we have immense power, but we just can't seem to take full control. And so another alliance is formed. Verse 17. Still couldn't conquer the south, so he married his daughter Cleopatra in an alliance. Verse 17. And he shall set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither before him. So it didn't work out for him. There's another alliance that was entered into. He married his daughter, thinking this will give me influence. But his daughter, Cleopatra, her name was, not the Cleopatra that we know of as in Antony and Cleopatra. She came 100 years after this Cleopatra. But this Cleopatra was married again to form an alliance. His plan didn't succeed, though, because she didn't stand with him. She sided with her husband against her father. And verse 18, Antiochus gave up his ambitions in the south. Verse 18. Now, this is what happened in history. We can all read these things. And after this shall he turn his face unto the isles, and shall take many. But a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him. So Antiochus gave up his ambitions in the south, set off for the coastlands of the Mediterranean, which referred to here as the Isles. and marched towards Asia Minor. A huge army. He's marching towards Asia Minor. He comes to Greece, but unfortunately for him, coming, marching with another army in the opposite direction is a Roman general. Now, Rome wasn't a world power at this point, but it was becoming one. So coming towards him, marching in the opposite direction, is a Roman general. And we know him as Lucius Cornelius Scipio. Now, he was a mighty general. He was a great military strategist also. And in fact, his brother, Publius Cornelius Scipio, was one of Rome's greatest generals of all time, and one of the greatest generals of the entire ancient world. This Publius Cornelius Scipio became so renowned for his victories. In fact, he was the man who defeated Hannibal, which gave him the title Africanus, so he was known as Africanus after that. And Hannibal also, one of the great military leaders of the ancient world, well, this Publius Cornelius Scipio defeated him and his elephants and became famous throughout Rome. In fact, in Rome, he started a fashion. Throughout the ancient world at this time, you went to almost anywhere in the world, most men who considered themselves real men were bearded. But this man, Publius Cornelius Scipio, this great general who defeated Hannibal, was clean-shaven. And soon the fashion in Rome among men was to be clean-shaven. So he started the fashion that Romans later became very renowned for. They were clean-shaven. And then wherever they went in the world, they were known for, oh, these clean-shaven faces. No bearded men, all clean-shaven. Well, that came from this Publius Cornelius Scipio, whose younger brother is the individual we're reading about here, marching in the opposite direction, is Lucius Cornelius Scipio, the younger brother of this Publius, who became so renowned. Well, it's no surprise that he was defeated by the Roman general. Massively, he was routed by Lucius Cornelius Scipio. He was humiliated and he returned home. Verse 19. We're near the end of our history section, by the way. Verse 19. Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. That's what happened. He just went home. He died shortly after. And that was the end of him. He was replaced by his son, Seleucus Philopater. Verse 20. And this Seleucus Philopater sent Heliodorus, an individual who was under his command, to raid the temple in Jerusalem. He didn't do it, though, because a vision warned him off. And he went back and he poisoned his boss, Seleucus Philopater. And Seleucus Philopater was followed by the man who we'll look at again next time, the man that we know of as Antiochus Epiphanes. That's how the history unfolded. And isn't it amazing how Daniel was given this in advance in such detail? When you read these verses and you compare them to what actually unfolded in history, you think, it's incredible. No wonder historians are convinced that this was written after these events. But that doesn't really stack up for a number of reasons. Well, what can we learn from a passage like this, and sort of when we sort of match it with the actual history that unfolded? What can we learn from that? Well, we can certainly, can't we, have confidence that the scriptures reveal the truth to us. You know, to reveal something like this, like a detailed prophecy like this, in such fine detail that you can actually pick up a history book and compare and match them. You know, set Daniel 11 here, history book here, and you can follow it verse by verse. If you look, you look up the right places, verse by verse. It gives us a confidence, doesn't it? that this word is true. There's so many things here that we don't understand. So many things here that, you know, we still try to work out and maybe find details about. You know, there are cities that we still haven't excavated and found, but we know they exist because they're recorded here. So we know they were real cities. And the fact they haven't been found, we can have confidence that God's word is true. When it talks about a city that maybe is no longer around, we know that it existed because it's recorded for us here, just as this prophecy was recorded for us in such detail. These events described so clearly unfolded for us. There's actually no evidence whatsoever that the book of Daniel was written at any other time than the time of the exile. The people will have you believe that it was written in the intertestament periods, when this style of writing became very popular. Obviously it was mimicked after Daniel's prophecy. But apocalyptic writing was very popular in the intertestament period, the 200 years before Christ, became a very popular style of writing. And so people think, oh, well, that's when it must have been written then, because it's sort of, a lot of it's very apocalyptic. Well, it's not all apocalyptic. You know, it's only these latter prophecies are written in the apocalyptic style, chapter 7, chapter 8, here in chapter 11. But the fact is, Ezekiel refers to Daniel as one of the great wise men of all time, along with Job and maybe just one other. One of the great wise men of all time, Ezekiel refers to Daniel in chapter 14 of Ezekiel, and chapter 28 also, he refers to Daniel specifically. So people who say that, well, Daniel didn't exist during the exile, I'm afraid Ezekiel thinks he did, and writes about him, mentions him in more than one place. Well, there only can be a supernatural explanation for this prophecy being so detailed and fulfilled in such specific ways. There only can be a supernatural explanation for that, for the accuracy of these prophecies. So we have a book of truth, which is based on the book of truth, which is in the heavens. His story, the story that God writes. That God is Lord of history. Christ is Lord of history. And as history unfolds, it's his story that he knows in advance, which is unfolding. So God knows in advance all that is happening down here. He knows it in advance because he wrote it in advance. How he wrote it, we don't know. But Revelation talks about the books being opened. And wouldn't it be a wonderful thing to see those books opened and find out what's in them and what kind of books they are and what they look like and what they reveal? Won't that be amazing? And that this word is based on those books, derived from those books, the words in this book derived from those books. Be amazing. Of course, there's another book that's opened at that time as well, which is the Book of Life, another fascinating book. And that's one that we're in. We're in that book. It's amazing to know that this book is derived from the book that God has written in advance. And we can have confidence also that when this book reveals to us the truth concerning Jesus of Nazareth as the Son of God made flesh, although most people in the world will say, well, that's nonsense. How can God become flesh? And there isn't a God anyway. Well, we can know that there is. And we can know that he was. Because we can see elsewhere in this book how the truthfulness of the prophecies, the truthfulness of what is spoken about, we can tangibly see. History records. Individuals who aren't even religious have written down the unfolding of those events that were prophesied. So this book reveals the fact that Jesus is truth personified. I am the way, the truth, and the life, he says. And when we see that Jesus is the Lord of history. God is always in control. When we read through those 20 verses, and we'll read through some more verses in chapter 11 in a few weeks' time. When you read through these verses, where is God? Is he mentioned at all? No, he isn't. Is he there? Yes, he is. The reason we can match up what's written by Daniel with what's written by historians is because God was there throughout it all. even though he's not seen to be there. And sometimes when we go through difficulties, we go through trials, we see the world going through turmoil, and we think, where is God in all of this? Well, he's in it all, working it all out. And nothing happens in history, but that's outside of his control. It's his story acted out in history, or acted out in time, I should say. It's his story. He's at work throughout the whole period of human history. When Jesus said, "My Father works hitherto, and I work," he's making that point. God is always at work. You don't always see him at work. You don't always see him at work in your own life, never mind in the world. But he is, as Jesus said, always at work in our lives and in the world. So these great empires that we've looked at, we've seen them in visions. We've seen them presented as an image. We've seen them presented as beasts, haven't we? In Daniel chapter 7, as beasts. All these empires rise and fall. And they rise and fall because God rises them up, or raises them up and makes them fall. They rise and fall at God's hand. It seems as if, doesn't it, when you read through history, it seems as if some of these great rulers could just do absolutely whatever they liked. It seems like that. You read the period during the Second World War, the rise of Hitler, the rise of Nazi Germany, and it looks at a point in time, looks like he can do whatever he likes, and no one can stop him. But he was stopped. And he was stopped because there's a God who's in control. And other empires have been stopped, and will be stopped. There's more to happen that God is going to control. There's more to happen. But he's in control. And God announces it all beforehand. So although God is nowhere to be seen in these verses, he's everywhere in these verses. Thank you.